When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
Hey, it's me, Jersey, and it's time for your Thunder Punch Daily, the show I record not so daily, sharing a few thoughts from the mind of a cartoonist. Just finished listening to an episode of the Spark CBC radio podcast, which an art and story pointed me at a while back, and I am absolutely hooked on it. I know in the past I've made fun of radio shows like Radiolab, This American Life, and Spark for being a little overproduced. If you listen to them, you'll know what I mean. It's not just a conversation as much as it is like a sort of like a work of art in audio with information, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that, you know, the cynic in me likes to take a little jab at it every once in a while and giggle at you know, how seriously they're taking it. And now I feel like I need to retract that statement because I take what I do pretty seriously too. So I'm going to stop making fun of them. But anyway, so I'm listening to the latest episode and there was a really interesting, I'll link to it in the show notes too. So the page that you're listening to this on will have a link to the episode in question. And, there was a really interesting segment of the show where they're talking about sci-fi predictions coming true. And during that particular piece, Nora Young, the, host of the show, interviewed or discussed with a guy named Eric Rabkin, who is actually a professor of English language, at the University of Michigan, right here in Ann Arbor. I could probably go to the guy's house if I knew where it was. And she was talking with him, trying to dig at the question of what role does science fiction play in the culture? Does it predict technological advances, or is there like a feedback loop where it goes back and forth and like one informs the other? And that Rabkin guy had a lot of interesting thoughts on it. But the really interesting part came right towards the end of the discussion in the context of the podcast. Now there's like a full length interview on the website too you can listen to if you find it really interesting. But in the context of the podcast, towards the end of the little bit that they played, she asked, what is it about science fiction that makes us so compelled by it? And his assertion, I thought, was very astute. He said something along the lines of, I see this is where if I did like a really produced show like Spark, I would actually play the clip here and I would like intersperse it with my voice. But there I go again, right? But he said something to the effect of, Even when science fiction predicts something frightening, like 1984, or in the example he used was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, there's something comforting about it because in the end, there's a work of art. There's a piece of literature. There's a piece of fiction there. And what did he mean by that? Well, he elaborates and he says that even in something like Hamlet, which ends very badly, there's still a sense of an internal order or logic or structure of the story. The world of the story makes sense. Now, I've said this many times in the past, not to say that this guy's ripping off my ideas. I just think that he and I and probably a lot of other fiction creators would agree on this point, is that stories don't have to have happy endings. They have to have sensible endings. They have to have some kind of structure and logic that is consistent to a certain degree to make us feel like this world has a cohesion to it. And he winds up quoting somebody else in the context of the interview where he says something along the lines of, in the real world, science fiction makes us all unwilling immigrants into the future. Yeah, the future can be very scary because we don't know what's going to happen. But in the terms of a story's logic, what makes a story, for most people, very compelling is a sense of, even if you don't see what's coming, when the end happens, you say, oh, that's only what could have happened. Now, I'm building a point here. Because this question comes around and around amongst us comics storytellers. How do you bootstrap a story? How do you get a story started? How do you build something that has an internal logic? And you guys know about my aversion to a 1-2-3-step plan to do anything. My attitude is ask a lot of leading questions to invite imagination and start to lead them to making their own decision process. But this is a podcast. I can't do that with you. I can't ask you a question like that, right? But so, you know, at the risk of starting to sound like a 1-2-3 step thing, I was inspired by something that Matt Fizzell did at the Ann Arbor Comics Artist Forum. Now, I shot some video from that, and I will link to that in the show notes as well. Matt Fizzell leads a very popular mini comics workshop, How to Make a Mini Comic. And one of the things he did at the beginning of his presentation, which initially made me kind of wince because I thought, oh, you can't say that. He broke it down into five things that a story needs, or that a comic needs, as a matter of fact, is what he said. And as I watched him work, I realized that this five things that he's throwing out, he wasn't throwing it out in any kind of definitive way. Like, if you just have these five things, you always have a comic. That's all. What he was doing was he was breaking it down to a simple sort of outline for people to build off of. Just giving them the absolute basic ingredients to say, okay, now mix and match. But here's, if instead of just throwing you into the deep end of the pool and say, swim, damn it, swim, he's saying, okay, here's a few different flotation devices to keep you going. And eventually you can let go of some of them as you get more confident in the waters. In that context, a list methodology of approaching making a story makes sense to me. Obviously, speaking as a teacher, and I'm speaking to anybody out there who is interested in leading comics workshops, you got to use some judiciousness, some judgment when it comes to whether or not to use something like that. It depends on your audience, after all. But I wanted to highlight a couple of things that he said. I don't know if I'm going to remember all five, and you can always watch the video if you're interested in seeing how he presented this information. But I want to highlight a couple of these things that it's a very simplified way of looking at it. And perhaps if you're really stuck, just go back to these basic ingredients and you'll probably find yourself drumming up some ideas for a story. And the first thing he started with was a panel. Stories have panels after all. Now, is a panel always a box? You guys know this. No. It could be a circle. It can be a burst shape. It can be a cloud shape. It can be no border at all. The panel is just the unit of time in the story as defined by images. Wow, did I just come up with that? Maybe I did. Contact Scott McCloud. We need to update Understanding Comics. And then he says the next thing is some text. And the first thing he chose was a caption box. Now, not every story requires caption boxes. It all depends on what kind of story you want to tell. But if we break it down to a basic ingredient that gets used from time to time in a comic, I use them in a lot of my stories. So let's take that as a basic ingredient. Caption box, some kind of narrative text, something that indicates to the reader that the story is beginning or giving the reader some information that images cannot deliver. And then he goes on to say a character. Interesting that he chose a narrative caption box before the character in how he broke it down. But then you put the character in the panel. And so he drew Cynical Man and he's walking along, or he's in a boat and he's going fishing or something like that. And then he says the next thing on the list is a word balloon, some dialogue. The characters have to be speaking after all. Now, do they always have to be speaking? Of course, they don't always have to be speaking. You can do pantomime comics. Look at Cal Baker's book, The Bakers. I believe 99%, if not all of that book, is done without dialogue. It's all done pantomime style. But what he's pointing at there is that there needs to be some kind of narrative communication on the part of the characters, not just the caption boxes, but the characters too. And again, basic ingredients, guys. Don't get on my case yet. And then he goes on to say that there needs to be some kind of conflict. Something needs to happen to the character to prevent them from doing the thing that they want to do. So Cynical Man is in the boat. He's going to go fishing. What's the conflict going to be? Well, he chose the Loch Ness Monster jumping out of the water. Okay, so it's a very bold and straightforward conflict, monster attack. And again, to extend on this line of thinking, all conflict is the preventing your main, your pro tag, or whoever you're sympathizing with in the story, from getting what they want, or confronting them with something that they fear. What do they want? What do they fear? Those are the ways you make a character that people care about. And I'm going to go into this more detail in a future Thunder Punch Daily because I have some notes in my Evernote for follow-up on this about writing characters that people give a darn about. And then the conflict has to be resolved in one way or another. Now let's go back about 5 minutes ago when I was talking about Hamlet. Doesn't end well. The rest is silence. Hamlet dies. Hope I didn't spoil anything for anybody. He makes a big mess out of everything, drives Ophelia crazy. But it's resolved. The conflict isn't hanging in the air. If the conflict wasn't resolved, it would have ended, you know, a half hour earlier, and Hamlet would have been walking around going, I got to get revenge on my uncle, you know, and then the end. That would be a non-resolved conflict, right? So did I break it down? Did I break down all five? Panel, caption box, character, dialogue, and conflict. Oh, and resolution. I guess I did six. So maybe I added one on to what Matt said. But anyway, I'm going to link to the video for you guys to follow up on and watch it. He does a really good presentation. And as I said, you know, if you look at breaking down something into a list, not as a definitive how-to, one, two, three, just do all these things and you will have magically a story. But look at it more like a recipe of ingredients that you are invited to play with. And you know what? I don't want to use that much salt in this. I don't like the salty food so much. I'm going to leave a little bit out. Or you know what? To make this, I want my roux to be a little thicker. I'm going to add a little bit extra flour this time. If you look at it like that, then I think it starts to make, it becomes a little bit more clear to me. And you know what? This is how I'm thinking about it right now, as of this recording, in January of 2011. I'm going to come back to this again and again and again because there's no one way to come at bootstrapping a story. And that's why listening to discussions with writers is so interesting, because they all have a different take on it. And all of their takes, at least in my opinion, tend to be valid. It's just another unique way of looking at it. And all of these things are, to use the tired old expression, I mean, really tired, talk of thousands of years old, pointing at the moon, right? We're pointing at the moon. You're not seeing the moon if you look at the finger. So all we're really trying to do is just find as many different expressions as possible to point at that moon so you can find your way to it on your own eventually. And you know what? That sounded a little bit like a didactic kind of teaching thing, when really, as a guy who's been doing this for a little while, and I'm sure some of you more experienced storytellers out there would agree with me, this is something we have to be reminded of over and over again, no matter where we are in our careers. So, we always lose our way back to that moon when we least expect it. And then that's where that inspiration becomes important. And where do we get inspiration from? From the ideas of others, after all. So, who am I? I'm Jersey Droz, jdroz.com, Jersey on the Twitters. Thank you very much for supporting us in this project. We could not do it without you. Welcome to the new subscribers. Looking forward to having office hours with some of you guys. I've already scheduled some. I've just spent the last 2 weeks trying to catch up on all of the email that's been coming in for Art and Story over the last couple weeks. If you haven't heard from me by now, email me again, because I believe I'm all caught up, but I might have missed some of you guys. So if you haven't heard from me in a couple weeks and you're waiting on a question or a thought, a response, something, a wondering, just fire off another email, artandstory@gmail.com, or you can email me directly, jerseydroz@gmail.com. So I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily. And until then, remember, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed today's adventure. You know, television is not the only way to be entertained by an exciting story. There is another way. It's called reading. And one of the wonderful things about books is that they allow you to choose whatever kind of adventure you like. A trip with an astronaut, an adventure with the great detective Sherlock Holmes, a comedy, anything. You can find it in a book at your school or neighborhood library. Why, I'll bet there are even some good books right in your own home, just waiting to be read.